From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm Ekta, I'm from Walnut Creek, and also from Thailand.
El Cerrito.
From Oakland.
From Albany, California.
Coming up, we look at the price tag for hosting the America's Cup.
So as of June 30th, the city incurred about $13.4 million in costs as of that date. And the organizing committee has reimbursed us for about $8.4 million of that $13.
Then we meet some Bay Area sailors whose time on the water comes with a different set of costs.
The width of the dock is a little scary, not knowing exactly where I am because I'm totally blind.
And we listen to young musicians tap into their musical genius.
Who's ready to rock?
They're making waves today on Cross Currents. If you walk along the San Francisco waterfront this weekend, you may notice several giant catamarans, these specialized 72-foot-long sailboats that whiz along the water at speeds topping 40 miles per hour. It's the first weekend of the America's Cup Finals, a race with a 162-year history, and they're here because Oracle billionaire Larry Ellison's boat won 3 years ago in Valencia, Spain.
After 2.5 years of controversy and litigation, finally, America's Cup 33 has been decided on the water. The America's Cup is America's again, this time to the Golden Gate Yacht Club, San Francisco.
Since then, the controversies have only gotten more complicated. Before the actual races even began this year, there were threats to cancel the whole thing. There were fights over safety regulations, revelations of cheating, even the death of a training sailor. And then there's the money. KALW's Angela Johnston looks into how much the America's Cup is costing San Francisco.
15 seconds to go before they hit the line.
It's a rare hot summer Saturday on the San Francisco Bay. A race between a pair of $10 million sailboats has just begun. Team Italy against Team New Zealand. Spectators at a viewing area on the Embarcadero lounge on beanbag chairs.
There comes the wind wash.
Piers 27 to 29 have been converted into a giant pavilion with big screen TVs, picnic tables, a concert space, and espresso machines at every corner.
At gate number 3, it is Emirates Team New Zealand with a lead of more than 700 meters.
New Zealand rounds the final mark near the Bay Bridge. Spectators run to the edge of the pier to watch the 130-foot-tall carbon fiber boat cross the finish line minutes before its competitor, Lunarossa, owned by Prada billionaire Patrizio Bertelli. The international sailing competitions here this summer have luxury plastered all over them. For months, Oracle, Louis Vuitton, and Emirates have been competing for ad space all over the San Francisco waterfront. And throwing an event like this costs big bucks, too. The most recent estimates show San Francisco will spend $22 million on building costs, port improvements, and extra police. City officials say it's worth it.
There's just all those, you know, incalculable things. Like, you know, San Francisco is being beamed across the globe.
Jane Sullivan works with the city's Office of Economic and Workforce Development.
You know, as the host of an international sporting event with these boats and our beautiful bay highlighting that in San Francisco. So, I don't, you know, you can't really put a value on that, but it's exceptional.
For the past 3 years, Sullivan's led the city's involvement in the America's Cup.
In 2010, we estimated that this event would produce about $1.4 billion in spending.
That was when they expected 15 countries to take part. It ended up being 4.
We redid those projections in April of this year to account for basically fewer teams, which made the most significant difference, and that number came down to about $900 million.
So she's saying the people of San Francisco would see almost $1 billion just because of the America's Cup. How does that work? Well, I called on an expert to explain.
Sure. My name is Ben Rosenfield. I work as the city controller.
He also acts as the auditor for the America's Cup Organizing Committee. He says to figure out where that $900 million is coming from, we need to think of people like
Jill Randall
from
Galveston, Texas,
who came out west with her husband because,
well, we wanted to see the race, and our daughter lives in Palo Alto.
Rosenfield says he starts counting the money as soon as the Randalls fly into town.
We'll fly into San Francisco International Airport, which is a city function. Just by virtue of landing, the airport receives fees.
Then they might spend a few nights in a hotel.
On average, they're spending $200 a night for a hotel room. So the city has approximately a 14% hotel tax. So for every night they stay in San Francisco, they're generating $30 in tax revenues from hotel tax.
And, of course, there's more.
While they're here, they're shopping at San Francisco businesses. They're buying things. That's generating sales tax. That sales tax, portion of the sales tax, comes back to the city to support city services. They might have rented a car. They're parking when they go to the event. They're paying parking tax on that. And then lastly, they're watching the event, which has a number of employees that have been brought in to build things, build boats, or to build venues. And that's generating payroll tax for the city.
You might have noticed something Rosenfield keeps coming back to.
Incidental tax revenue, hotel taxes, business taxes, and others. And then the tax revenue would be above and beyond sales tax, generating significant tax revenue benefits to the city on its bottom line.
By virtue of the America's Cup coming to town, the city expected to get anywhere from $13 to $19 million in tax revenues. But that was based on drawing 2 million fans to the sailboat races. By the end of August, only about a quarter of that number had shown up. City budget analysts told me all hotels in San Francisco were booked full for August and September. But Rosenfield says that could just be a sign of a strong tourist season. And anyway, there's guys like
Barry Christensen. I'm from Seattle, Washington.
He's not even staying in a hotel. He got here by boat.
We're moored out here at Pier 39 and hanging on the boat and taking a layover day and week and just having a great time enjoying the racing.
The Kiwis have extended their lead, and here they are bringing it back to America's Cup Park. The fans are waiting.
There are just about 2 weeks of races left. The city is hoping more visitors will help them break even. A nonprofit formed to cover costs has come up about $5 million short so far, and city controller Rosenfield says he doubts they're going to make it up.
I don't think anyone's expectation at this point is full reimbursement. But we're certainly hoping, I'm certainly hoping that that gap is as little as possible.
Somebody's down below, I think, trying to fix hydraulic issues.
It all means that when two of the most expensive sailboats in the world face off for the America's Cup this weekend, the city of San Francisco will still be far behind. On the Embarcadero, for Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
Do you think the America's Cup is worth it for the city? Let us know what you think on our Facebook page. We're KALW. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. While the America's Cup is here for only a short time, sailing in San Francisco is here to stay. With 8-foot dinghies, multi-million dollar yachts, and everything in between docked at the city's many marinas. All told, sailing can be a pretty pricey sport, physically demanding and technical too. The Bay Area Association of Disabled Sailors, or BADS, has been lowering these obstacles in San Francisco for 25 years. On just a shoestring annual budget of under $50,000, the organization offers sailing lessons every weekend to its members at McCovey Cove near AT&T Park. KALW's Daniel Moore recently spent the day sailing with BADS to bring you this story.
I'm next to the Java House restaurant near AT&T Park, walking down an aluminum ramp toward a small fleet of boats. At the end of a dock, I meet Kathy Pugh, Brian Pease, and Sebastian DeFrancesco. They're all in electric wheelchairs.
I broke my neck snow skiing Christmas Eve, 1979, which basically rendered me paralyzed from the shoulders down.
I have cerebral palsy. It affects my motor skills.
I have a C5, C6 spinal cord injury sustained when I was in the military. I was hit by a landmine, and I was blown out of a military jeep, and next thing I knew, I woke up in a hospital, and I was paralyzed for 37 years since then.
They're here at Pier 40 to take part in one of the club's races. It's a group effort getting everyone ready. Some volunteers use a lift, while others carry disabled sailors over to small boats called access dinghies. Kathy Pugh is a retired lawyer and served as BAD's Commodore in the mid-1990s. Her boat's been modified with electronic controls called servo motors.
So I use my hands a little bit so I can control this joystick here on this side.
Not all of the sailors can use their hands to navigate their boats. Christina Ribke, the current Commodore at BADS, uses her chin to operate her sailboat. She has a rare disorder called atrogryposis multiplex congenital.
And all that means is that basically in the womb, my muscles and nerves didn't develop properly, and so I don't have any use of my arms and legs or any functional use. I can kind of wiggle my toes a little bit and wiggle my fingers a little bit, but nothing useful.
Ribke gives me a quick explanation of how her boat works.
We have to strap a board to around my torso so that the chin control or the joystick that I sail with can sit under my chin. I have three motors, and those all run through a relay box that is hooked into the joystick that I use that sits under my chin.
Rebke's a seasoned sailor, while Gulf War veteran Patrick Finan will be sailing his own boat for the first time today.
First and foremost, it's a new and unknown. I ski downhill, I've done rock climbing, judo, and different activities, but this is the first time I've been around sailboats in a long, long time, so it's the width of the dock is a little scary, not knowing exactly where I am, because I'm totally blind.
As a blind sailor, Finan will be in a two-person sailboat with a skipper to lend a hand. He can get additional help on the water from volunteers on chase boats. I'm invited out onto one to watch today's race. As we slowly trail behind the sailors, the strong smell of exhaust hangs over our boat. From another motorboat, the referee calls the start of the race. Pugh and Ribke quickly pull into the lead. Other sailors lag behind with technical difficulties.
Back up, more. Take all the way around. Turn, go.
This way?
Yeah, keep going, just like that.
You got it. A little further?
He's clear.
Okay, I'm in neutral. Okay, and just like that, our sailor is clear. So it looks like he was trying to round the mark a little bit too closely, and sometimes it happens, the boat just gets completely caught up in the buoy.
The racing is done after a few hours. One of the sailors is stranded, so we tow them back to the dock. I ask Ribke for the results.
I don't usually do this well, but I did get... I won 4 out of 5 of the races. I got first place, and then I got second place in the one I didn't win.
Ribke sounds a bit embarrassed by her success, but no one at BADS is really keeping a tally. Sailing here is about cooperation, not competition. For volunteer Ryan Olson, it's even a life-changing experience.
I've learned how to sail, how to rig boats, and I've actually learned a lot about people with disabilities that I maybe had misconceptions about before I started working with them. Really, they are every bit as capable as you or I, if not more so. Out on the water, they just smoke everyone in these boats. They're incredible to watch.
On the San Francisco Bay, I'm Daniel Moore for Cross Currents.
This week, BADS is hosting the Access Class North American Championship, and tomorrow is the last day to see members from BADS and sailors from as far away as the Netherlands and Australia compete. If you miss the competition tomorrow, BADS also has sailing programs most weekends year-round, and for more information, you can go to our website, klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. If we're lucky, teachers and mentors start giving us the tools to do great things when we're very young. And hopefully, figuring out how to use those tools can feel like play rather than work. Welcome to Rock Band Land. It's a place where 4 to 8 year olds are introduced to music by learning to write it themselves. They go through the whole process up to when they're on stage in front of hundreds of screaming fans. KLW's Teddy Lederer takes us through their musical journey.
Seventeen kids sit cross-legged in a circle as they start spitting out ideas for their new song of the week.
We can write about anything we want, anything at all. We can write about an emotion. We can write about a feeling. We can write about a question. We can write about an adventure. We can write about something.
At the helm of this imaginative brainstorm is one of the two adults in the room, Brian Gorman. The only characters off limits? Zombies. One girl says they give her nightmares.
Well, who are they? Tell me about them. Are they all boys? Are they all girls? Are they boys and girls?
They're
are they
boys
friends?
And girls. Boys and girls.
Boys and girls. How old are they? So, Rohan.
About six and nine.
About our age, like six, yeah, seven, six, eight, nine.
Yeah. Okay. Six, seven, eight, nine, heading to the movies by themselves. That in itself is an adventure, a little dangerous and a little scary for some people.
Maybe they're grandma and grandpa.
No, their grandma and grandpa turned to lizards.
Their grandma and grandpa got shocked by lightning.
Gorman is one of the founders of Rock Band Land. 7 years ago, he was working as a preschool teacher by day, rocker by night, when the idea for Rock Band Land came to him. At the time, the music he was sharing with his young students was driving him a little nuts.
It was all cute, like bubblegum, like kind of just maddeningly irritating, like condescending music. And I was like, you know, like we can write a punk rock song with these kids, no problem. You know, they were four years old. I was like, we can easily write a punk rock song with four-year-olds.
So he started an after-school program, co-directed by his friend Marcus Stays, who joined 4 years ago.
I think our first song together was a two-chord, kind of like a Weezer song or something. Just really silly and simple and actually wasn't that catchy. It's just simple and silly. And then I realized after that, oh, we can make music that we both really like out of this because these ideas are great and there's this never-ending supply of ideas.
There are 4 rules to the songwriting process at Rock Band Land. Each song has to be original, no potty words, listen to each other's ideas, and the story cannot be mean-spirited.
Wait, guys, one second, let Odin do it again, then I want you guys to play along.
When it's time for the kids to write the music, they're separated into groups. Each one picks their favorite instrument, from keyboard to tambourine to guitar and drums, and tries to find a pattern that will fit with their song. And what's key to the Rock Band Land approach is that no kid is told how to play or given formal training. It's about feeling it out as they hear it in their heads. Rock Band Land is one of at least half a dozen rock schools in the Bay Area. The idea got popular after the 2003 hit movie, School of Rock.
What makes you mad more than anything in the world?
No allowance. Chores. Bullies.
All you bullies get out of my way, because I am really ticked off.
Marcus Stays and Brian Gorman say their approach remains unique because of the amount of power that the children have in the whole process.
We operate under the guise of a rock camp, but we spend a lot of time just creating with the kids and coming up with just silly things to say or new ideas, all centered around the central story and song that we end up writing at the end of the camp.
We can really, really go to some like crazy fun places and have the energy kind of in any other class situation would seem totally nuts. But we can go there with our rockers because we really try to like emphasize respecting each other and the band and music and creating in general.
And part of that is giving students the real rock star experience of getting on stage.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, rockers and non-rockers alike, are you ready for the big show?
At the end of the six-week camp, around 300 parents and fans crowd into a theater in San Francisco's Mission District. Everyone is decked out in their favorite band's merchandise and line up outside the door to get a good seat.
Who here is a mom or dad of someone in a band?
Gorman says this performance is essential to the Rock Band Land experience.
the shows do wonders for kids. Like, we'll have lots of young rockers who are really, you know, at first a little shy or nervous even to just talk to Marcus and I, let alone be on stage with 300 people. And then 6 weeks later, they're on there and they are just screaming their heads off into the microphone. And you know, it's sort of transformative for some of them, which is, you know, for us as like artists and teachers, that's like, that's it right there. That's the reward. Like, you know, as we know that, like, that's going to stay with them, you know, and it's a big thing.
It's no coincidence that the songs written at Rock Band Land are punk rock. The idea is to let kids break free from the mold of bubblegum pop and Disney cartoons. In this place, kids are allowed to sing about war, character death, magic gone awry, and good people going evil.
There are horrible things that happen in life, and kids are exposed to so much stuff, and we're all processing things differently. And, you know, we've found really wonderful ways to, like, explore kind of scary ideas, you know, through these kind of wild, you know, sometimes a little demented or, you know, just magical stories.
And what might otherwise be sad or infuriating just becomes an excuse to rock out.
Anything is possible, everything is possible, even the impossible in Rock
and Land.
Reporting from deep within Rock Band Land, I'm Teddy Lederer for Cross Current.
Jeffrey is a class gorilla, but he's not a teacher's pet. We each get a week to take him home. I haven't had my chance yet. We were studying.
If you want to know more about how your kids can rock out, visit our website, kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. All week long on KALW, we've been playing you this sound.
When you hear me holler out, heave, you pull really hard, and what do you say?
Ho.
That was terrible. Heave.
Ho.
There you go. We'll get a lot of work done that way.
Many of you knew exactly what and who that was.
I know that was Alice Watts.
I think it was Alice Watts.
That is Alice Watts on the Alma at Hyde Street Pier.
I can identify the sound. It's my wife.
Alice Watts.
Who is calling the commands for people to haul on the lines.
Alice Watts is the first mate on the Alma, a historic flat-bottom boat that sets sail from San Francisco's Maritime Park to help people understand what it was like to work on the bay. Watts has been teaching people how to sail the boat for 20 years.
I came here as a parent chaperone, and I never left. And I'm having a great time. I love being on board. It's my life.
KALW's Julie Kane got aboard the Alma to learn why being out on the water can help us have a better understanding of where we live.
Yes. Would you introduce yourself to me? Just tell me your first and last name. And
oh, Charter is the first name, and the last name's Kays, K-A-Y-S.
And do you work on this boat, or what's your...
I'm the lead shipwright at the Maritime Museum, or we call it the Maritime Park now. I think maritime education is important because the city of San Francisco and this whole area was really built by maritime trade. When gold, you know, was found at near Sutter's Mill and all the rest of that, you had all these immigrants coming from around the world to California, you know, and then the major port at that time was San Francisco and the San Francisco Bay Area. Well, people would come to San Francisco to get outfitted to go up to the gold fields. And you had immigrants from around the world. Everybody was coming here looking to make a buck, okay? The people who were really making the money were the merchants who were in the cities. The merchants in the Sacramento area and whatnot and everything. They were selling all sorts of goods and supplies to the miners and then all the related trades that were involved. So the city, you know, developed with as a working man's town. You had saddle makers and you had blacksmiths and you had shipsmiths. Those are blacksmiths that specialize in making iron parts and stuff like that for ships. You had boat builders and ship builders. You had it, the city was full of trades. You know, there's a tremendous, phenomenal amount of history here in California that if you go at it full bore all the time, you can't even make a dent in it. And here in the Bay Area, you've got all this kind of history coming together. The Old West meets up with the maritime trade, the Cape Horn trade, the days of 49, the whole thing. It's phenomenal.
Well, a lot of you got this week's sound right, including Alice Watts' husband, Bob. And you all even knew that it was a scow schooner. But there can only be one winner, and that is Tom Hunt. Congratulations, Tom. You're our winner, and we're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. For everyone else, we'll have a new mystery sound next week, and we're going to give you some extra time to figure this one out. You have until Monday, September 16th, to tell us what it is and where we recorded it. Here's a sneak peek.
Down on the yard.
Cookies on the tier, cookies.
$1 all on the line. $1 all on the line.
Strip down. Ting, 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 ting. Second tier, chow time.
Five is locked up. Ding.
Ding. Not quite sure what that was? Stay tuned to KALW to hear it again, or check out Audiograph on our website, kalw.org. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Linda Jew, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Holly J. McDeed, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our senior producer. Our executive editor is Ben Trefney. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. This is the Marcus Shelby Orchestra. They'll be premiering Blues and the Pursuit of Freedom this Saturday at San Francisco's Yerba Buena Gardens Festival. It starts at 1 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.